Woody Harrelson planted those seeds.
Yeah, I think I remember
I've got
that.
To meet a lot of different folks over the years. I met this fellow named Jack Herer down in 1982 in Los Angeles, and we both moved to Oregon to work on the Oregon Marijuana Initiative in 1984. You know you're getting old when you get the wrong decade.
Jack Herer, that's a famous name in these circles.
That's true. He wrote a pretty famous book called The Emperor Wears No Clothes about the history of hemp. And I had helped him with that. I'm in the dedication. And so a lot of these other names as well. So
I really do appreciate your time and your input and your cannabis warrior activism. You're one of the greats around here. And I am glad and honored to be able to talk with you today.
Well, you're very welcome, Trevor. I appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you for listening to my interview with Paul Stanford. Music is produced by J. Cody Robertson. I'm Trevor Collins. Be sure to look for more episodes wherever you get your podcasts at times like now. I'll be talking with you next time.
Joseph Galliban. If you want to win two tickets to Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the exhibition, just answer one trivia question, the answer to which can be found in this week's radio show. The question is, which Pope commissioned Michelangelo to paint the Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel? Answers to KBU Art Focus @gmail.com. I'll pick a random winner next week.
My name's Joseph Galliban, and you're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Nina Olson. She's a conservator of paintings and has studied, practiced, and taught conservation in Florence, Italy, and has studied the Old Masters. Nina is here to talk about Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the exhibition, which runs now at Pioneer Place Mall through August 21st. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Nina.
Happy to be here. I was very curious to see what it would look like down here.
We're down in what used to be the old gap on the ground floor of the mall, and it's kind of, you can't really see from the street, from the mall, but as you go in, there's a whole warren of giant friezes. These are Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel and Last Judgment images that have been photographed and then blown up on a sort of nylon-y, stretchy fabric. What's your first impression, Nina, as someone who went to the Sistine Chapel during the restoration in the 80s?
Well, for one thing, they're close. They're pretty close. They're probably life size. It's very close to the size of the murals themselves. But having seen them in person, and of course many reproductions, they lack a little bit of the sharpness and detail of Michelangelo's original marks, his original hand that's so stunning and quick and sure and filled with beautiful brushstrokes and directionality. And some of that is not really visible, but it's exciting to see them in such grand scale.
Yeah, I'd say these are 10, 12 feet high. The first one we're looking at is the Drunkenness of Noah. So Michelangelo used the ceiling of the Sistine Chapel to tell Old Testament stories in picture form, and one of them is the story of Noah and the flood. Here we've got Noah drunk as a skunk, sitting on the floor naked with a little bowl. It must be his wine mixing bowl. And there's people kind of looking after him, basically. Noah's hair and gray beard, there is no brush stroke. So when you look at photos of these works, usually Michelangelo used the brush stroke to define individual hairs. Is that correct?
Well, certainly to define form. So the fresco as an art form is considered to be like an eternal painting form, because the painter uses dilute pigments that are brushed onto wet plaster and they soak into the plaster. So it's a very rapid, quick technique that then conserves the sign of every single brushstroke. There isn't a lot of mixing, it's more like overlapped brushstrokes. So the brushstrokes are part of the technical profile of fresco painting in general. So, yeah, you don't see that as much. There are some things you can see. For example, the contour around the central figure, you can see sort of a dark circle that runs around him. So another characteristic of fresco is that it's actually performed in what are called giornate, or what the painter could paint in one day. So he would only extend plaster in the area that he would be able to complete while the plaster was wet, so in one day. So you can see a little bit of that, which is an interesting technical part of fresco painting.
So Michelangelo might have gone up there and had his plasterer guy, he'd be like, here, do this 6x4 section, and then he'd quickly get painting on it, and by the end of the day, it would be dry, almost dry.
I don't know exactly how he transferred his drawing, and I think a lot of these he did spontaneously with no transfer of drawing. So he just, in his mind, envisioned how much he would be able to do, and it wasn't usually a geometric form. It's usually an organic form, and it follows the shape of a figure or, you know, some other form in the painting. So the giornate are usually kind of like squiggly lines so that it looks like puzzle pieces and you don't really see them as much. It's not visually evident usually.
Well, fresco's Italian for fresh, right?
Fresh, yeah, exactly. So painting on the fresh lime plaster while it's still wet.
And you compared it to watercoloring in that you don't have a lot of time before the colors blend, it's a very spontaneous art, is that right?
Exactly. So it's usually, as in most Florentine artists' tradition, there's already a preconceived idea, there's a drawing, there's a concept that guides the process. So there's already an idea of what the painting is going to appear like. So he kind of follows that drawing in his mind, and that's what the giornate are corresponding to, like areas of the composition. And the fresco, yeah, it's a plaster that's mixed. I think that a lot of the plaster that he used in the Sistine was more what they used in Rome. So they had pozzolana, which is more gray, and calcium, and so the actual underlying plaster is a little bit grayer than very bright white as you see in other cities.
More in the Noah series is a huge panel called The Great Flood, and it shows the ark after the flood is starting to recede. People are fleeing the ark for dry land, and there's a man carrying the body of his son who may have been drowning. People are carrying furniture and stuff. There aren't many animals around. I don't really see them. But what was... just tell us about, you know, who commissioned this Sistine Chapel ceiling, and then how did Michelangelo get into the process of picking his drawings?
I mean, what you see here represents, like, quite an arc of time. I think he started painting the Sistine when he was in his early 30s, and he didn't complete the Last Judgment till he was 60. So it was actually commissioned by various different popes, or supervised by various different popes. The one that commissioned the original vault and the pendentives and lunettes was Julius II, Giulio II delle Rovere, and it was based on the absolute fantastic reception of his Tondo Doni, which is a round painting of the Holy Family that you find today at the Uffizi, where he used these twisted figures and this intense, like almost metallic effect to represent skin and really beautiful colors and everything. So based on that, he was given the commission to do this early part of the first phase, let's say, of the Sistine decoration, which was the vaults and the lunettes. And then the second campaign was actually commissioned by Clemente VII, Clement VII, who is a Medici pope later on after the sack of Rome. So it actually covers a few different popes.
That round painting, was that an oil painting or a fresco?
It was, I think it's egg tempera and oil mixed. Yeah, so it's really extraordinary, like just a jewel-colored representation.
So they said, you know, can you do this big, colorful Bible story? What was he doing with the Noah section, which is sort of very complicated and hard to see from the ground?
I believe that it represents maybe some of the earliest concepts that he had that had a lot of figures and a lot going on. And I think over time he simplified quite a bit the compositions. Furthermore, he wasn't very technically well versed in fresco, and I believe that this, the Great Flood, was one of the earliest ones that he did, and they were unsuccessful technically. They just didn't adhere well, or there wasn't good color saturation, or for whatever reason he decided to take them down and redo them again. So this was sort of like just dipping his toe in the pool of how it would be to paint on this grand scale with this new technique that he was totally unfamiliar with.
But he got the hang of it because he fired his assistants and just went it alone.
I think so, yeah. Over time, he just eventually had one assistant that was helping to, you know, make plaster and things like that, but he eventually painted most of it by himself completely, yeah.
There's a bench in front of this one because they know everyone wants to see it and linger. It's called the Creation of Adam, and it's God the Father surrounded by cherubs, leaning his right arm out with his forefinger out, and Adam is sort of lounging back, and he's got his left arm out, and their fingers are almost touching. So this is God creating Adam, man.
As you know, just a few years before he actually painted this cycle, there were massive archaeological excavations going on, and new pieces of antiquity were coming to light. And in particular, just like 2 years before, he was actually present for the unearthing of the Laocoon, which is the large antique grouping of the Laocoon and his sons that are being struggling with snakes. It's just fantastic, one of the most famous pieces of antiquity. So these things were coming to light and were obviously astonishing, and you can see that in all the figures, all these beautiful twisting torsos that were so influenced by antiquity that was literally coming out of the earth as he was studying and as he was working. There is one little small thing that perhaps people are not aware of, the very tip of the index finger of Adam that's reaching forward was actually a restoration done in the mid-16th century by another painter, Domenico Carnevale, because the Sistine Chapel was riddled with problems early on of water infiltration. They just didn't have it well sealed, the walkways above the ceiling itself. So early on, there were some massive issues with water infiltration that caused damage to the plaster, and that was one repair that was done early on. You'll see throughout a lot of the other images, you can see these bronze pins that were also inserted in the plaster to try to stabilize it from cracking and delamination.
For centuries, this work was sort of dark brown, and, you know, people thought, oh, he just sort of drew. He wasn't very interested in color. And then in the 1970s, Nippon TV paid for the restoration, and they filmed every second of it over several years. Tell us a bit about that restoration. And that's kind of how we know the piece today. Those colors emerged then.
Exactly, exactly. Everybody before the 1980s knew the Sistine Chapel as something that almost looked like a grisaille, like done in grayscale. And it perpetuated this mythology of Michelangelo as only a three-dimensional thinker, somebody that thought about sculpture and chiaroscuro but didn't think about color. And when they first started testing in, 1979, they were actually pretty shocked about how intense the color is. We know in retrospect it makes perfect sense because he was given the commission because of the Tondo Doni, which is like sort of a triumph of color. But it created a lot of apprehension on the part of historians and some artists. In particular, there was a professor from Columbia University named James Beck who created an organization called ArtWatch International, I believe, and he was raising the strongest objections because the cleaning process was completely, radically changing people's concepts of who Michelangelo was. He wasn't just a drawer, a draftsman, a three-dimensional thinker. He was a colorist. But it was constantly in the newspapers, on television. It was a huge media frenzy to discuss this, whether it was the right thing to do or not. And ultimately, the transparency and the solidity of the conservation methodology was triumphant. And so it's probably the most important 20th century conservation project because of that, because of how it radically changed people's conceptions of who Michelangelo is. He's a multifaceted artist, not just a sculptor. So it's exciting. It made a huge impact on me personally in my formative years.
My name's Joseph Gallivan. You're listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week is Nina Olson. She's a Portland-based conservator of paintings and an expert in Old Masters and Italian art. She's here at Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the exhibition, which runs at Pioneer Place Mall in downtown Portland through August 21st. One of the pieces next to the creation of Adam looks very different. The texture, the colors are all different. Does this one of the sacrifice of Noah, where they're going to build the pyre, they're getting the fire ready, is this closer to what you would see in person?
Well, certainly there's a higher degree of sharpness and there's definition in brush strokes and everything, but ultimately we're looking at a reproduction. We're not looking at the real thing, and it's incredibly difficult and complicated to have perfect color rendering. I would say the colors are a little bit accentuated, it's a little oversaturated, but there is much a higher degree of sort of, you can see the individual contours and it's just a little sharper. So this one is closer, although I do think that it's more saturated than the original is.
Mm-hmm. Do you think it could be a good thing to crank up the colors for a popular audience?
Clearly. I mean, this is supposed to be sort of a spectacular encounter with these things. And the fact that his coloring ability was the absolute novelty of this conservation, and now it represents a very strong, you know, feature of the Sistine. I mean, not only is it fabulous in its draftsmanship and its conception and its composition, but it's also these exciting colors. So I think that it kind of accentuates that aspect for certainly and makes it exciting to look at.
Mm-hmm. If you look at the one called The Ancestors of Christ, Salmon. Spelled like salmon. It's a woman cutting fabric with big shears. A little child is looking on, and then there's a man in the background. That must be Salmon leaning over. But you can see these sort of score marks in the body of the child where the muscles are and the outline. And then in the woman's face, the eyebrows, eyelids, mouth and nose have these score marks. What are they?
Those are incisions from his preparatory cartoon, it's called. It's a life-size drawing. So he would have held it up to the fresh plaster, and while before he started painting it, quickly sort of transferred the contours, as you said, those kind of key lines that define the figure and maybe some of the drapery and whatnot. And then he was just able to pull the piece of paper away and quickly paint on top of it. Mm-hmm. So those are transfers of the composition that he had previously thought out and developed on a piece of paper called a cartoon.
Are these score marks? He's using a stick to press.
Yeah, some kind of stylus. Yeah, exactly. Okay. And just kind of, and the plaster is so soft that it just kind of made a little incision mark right there. Yeah.
And then one thing I didn't realize, a lot of the ceiling is trompe l'oeil. It's like, I thought it was all vaulted and covered in, you know, mm-hmm. marble sort of architectural elements, but they're all just painted.
Yes, yeah. Like, that's part of the whole decorative scheme, was the invention of this, you know, fantastical architectural framing that, you know, goes around each one of the different scenes and each one of the different figures around the windows and whatnot. Yeah. Some of the features are actually real. Like, for example, the windows in the lunettes, those are actual architectural moldings, but everything else is painted. And they think that the fact that the windows were present created a situation where there was, like, visually, it was backlit. So he may have even made more intense and saturated colors to sort of balance that effect of being backlit from the window.
What do you mean backlit?
For example, if you hang a painting right next to a window, the light coming in the window kind of washes it out. It makes it so it's hard to see those colors or the image. And so he kind of compensated for that effect of the window by creating really, really strong colors right in those, in proximity to the window.
Mm-hmm. The fall of man and expulsion from paradise is also very, you know, it's an icon. You'll see this as illustrating all sorts of things as you go through your life, literature, advertising, and it's Adam and Eve. I think the serpent has bodily form wrapped around the tree, and then to the right-hand side, Adam and Eve are being banished, and there's an angel clubbing them and sending them on their way. They've gone from being kind of full of vim and vigor to looking like, you know, they've been up for 3 days, they're all wrinkled and
yes.
They look terrible.
Prematurely aged, yes. And his hair comes up almost like little horns.
Oh, yeah.
Is that interesting? Yeah, it's just a complete difference. This sort of luminous youth on the left before, you know, as Lilith is giving the apple, and then on the right, you know, life after being expelled from paradise.
So the show is mostly these really big panels, and then the Last Judgment, which Michelangelo painted behind the altar in the chapel later. It was another big commission. They were like, okay, do the Last Judgment. Christ, all the people going to heaven, all the people going to hell. That is represented here as just a small banner. It's probably, you know, 12 by 10. But the blue shines through, and it is quite in focus.
It's incredible. And as we were saying, it was kind of a different phase of, it was a completely different commission by Clement VII, who was a, you know, Medici Pope. And it was in response to the sacking of Rome. So it, you know, it was supposed to have this repentant quality, like trying to be closer to God and closer to the purpose of the church. And it's supposed to be perhaps one of the most personal and intimate pieces that Michelangelo ever made. He himself carrying the shame and of being a sinner his whole life. He's deeply religious himself. But and the blue, that like sort of whole, the just like the heavenly blue, is the first thing that you see. And again, that was completely invisible before the cleaning. All of the figures in this last panel, you know, raised enormous controversy, and there were calls to destroy the entire mural soon after it was done. In the end, areas were added on by a painter named Daniele da Volterra, called Il Braghettone, which means pantaloon. So he added all of this pantaloons that covered a lot of the figure's genitals so that they would be more in alignment with what was considered decorous for the chapel, that have now been removed for the most part.
At the time, when Michelangelo finished, all the nakedness was... That was controversial?
Absolutely, yeah. In fact, some of his biggest critics are actually represented in the mural. There's one figure that has a figure that's been completely, you know, the skin has been taken off. It's a scorticato, and it has Michelangelo's face. So initially, he was sort of making fun of how he was being, you know, treated so badly by many of his critics.
As a composition, this is spectacular. All the people's eyes are all on Jesus, but it just sort of floats in the air. And how many figures do you think? Maybe a hundred?
100 or more, yeah.
Probably more.
Absolutely. Yeah, and it's just this incredible turbulence in the Last Judgment, the emotion in the Last Judgment scene, and below the damned, and everybody's so, you know, it's just a moment of very intense emotion, and it shows in all of the faces.
I'm quite enjoying this exhibit because you do get to stand in front of it and get very close and look, and it's really, there's not many people here, so you're not being hurried along. How do you feel about it?
It's you know, it's like looking at a huge picture book, and not necessarily the highest quality productions, but it's exciting. It's nothing like going to the place, which is a completely different experience when you're in the architectural context inside the Vatican. I mean, it's just a whole different experience. But it does give you the opportunity, especially for people that haven't been able to travel, to perhaps have a glimpse into what it would be like, just the monumentality of the figures, the massiveness of them, the invention, the genius in all of the compositions. I think it could be fun for anybody to come and look.
I think of it as sort of homework, like if you are going to Rome, then you might want to do this before, so you just so you know what to expect.
I think they have alternating on and off illumination inside the chapel. So sometimes the lights are on and you see them more like this, and then they turn them off so that you just have natural light coming in, the lunettes. So these are very, you know, they're sort of glowing because of the medium that they were printed on is like a polyester, you know, it almost has a beautiful sparkle to it, and then it has very intense halogen lamps. So I think it glows a little bit more than they do in real life, but it definitely does, you know, give you an idea of his capacity as a colorist and just the monumentality. The size of them alone is just incredible. Just the variety of poses. I mean, just the seeing the body from every possible perspective.
The other good thing is I've been to Florence and Rome, and you just, as a tourist, you get so tired, and you're looking at all these things, and you know, you spend 5 hours in a museum and you get kind of, you can't take it in.
Stendhal syndrome.
Is that right, the writer?
Yes, it's called Stendhal. So he fainted from being overwhelmed by all of the aesthetic beauty and
Okay. I don't think I was fainting from that. I was more like really hungry and just wanted to sit down. But at least here, you're not under any pressure and you can sort of enjoy it, you know.
Mm-mm. I mean, as somebody that's an objects-based conservator, it's not the same. I mean, you're looking at something that's a reproduction. It's not the real thing. And I always encourage people, if they can, to make that pilgrimage to see, to have that sublime kind of direct interaction with a work of art, because it's a completely different level of touching history and seeing the real thing in person. But of course, I mean, this is it's a fun experience for anybody that loves to draw. Every single perspective of a human figure is shown. I mean, it's just, for somebody to come down and sketch from it, I think it would be quite fun.
My name is Joseph Gallivan, and you've been listening to Art Focus on KBOO Portland. My guest this week was Nina Olson. She's a conservator of paintings, and she was talking about Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the exhibition, which runs at Pioneer Place Mall through August 21st. Thanks very much for doing Art Focus, Nina.
It was fun. Thanks, Joseph, for having me.
This is Joseph Gallivan. If you want to win two tickets to Michelangelo's Sistine Chapel, the exhibition, just answer one trivia question, the answer to which can be found in this week's radio show. The question is, which Pope commissioned Michelangelo to paint the Last Judgment in the Sistine Chapel? Answers to kbooartfocus@gmail.com. I'll pick a random winner next week.
Andy Warhol looks a scream.